Good evening, this is Mark Lynch and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is archaeological writer Brian Fagan. He's the Emeritus Professor at the University of California in Santa Barbara. And we're talking about his latest book, Fishing: How the Sea Fed Civilization. Brian, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Mark.
The scope of this book is breathtaking. You include details of what we know from literally from prehistory and from peoples and civilizations all over the world and how to use fish and shellfish as a resource. This has got to have been a culmination of a life's interest, was it?
It's, in a way, a culmination of work and thinking I've been doing for about 40, 50 years, actually, ever since I went to Africa, where I met subsistence fishermen for the first time. And I've sort of visited all sorts of places and sites and looked at collections and looked at books and so on and talked to a lot of people. And this is the kind of bringing together of the whole thing. It was great fun doing it.
It's great fun reading it. I want to say this to the benefit of people. You know, usually with like an academic book like this, you know, it's deadly. But this is really fun. And it's fascinating stuff. Now, I'm going to just skip around because we could do an entire half hour any one chapter. But I want you to talk about the importance of catfish and early fishing. Why catfish?
Catfish are a bottom fish. They actually do thrive in mud on land and can move over land in some cases. They are easy to catch because they get trapped in shallow pools when river floods or lakes are receding. And you simply walk into the water. You can drive them into even shallower water if you have enough people. Or you fill them with your toes, and if you're clever, you can pick them out of the water, which makes them a very ideal catch to harvest in large numbers, which is how fishing began, I think, in East African lakes and on the Nile. And this was an easy sort of food, and of course it was a food which presumably predators also took, and the first humans saw predators taking them and simply copied them, and then they would, with the sort of opportunism which all fishing involves, would be at the right spots at the right moment when the catfish were spawning and being isolated in shallow pools and harvest them. And immediately, I suspect, they would dry a lot of them in the sun and eat them later.
Now, there seems to be almost a renaissance of understanding ancient fishing. Are people finally paying attention to the remnants of kitchens and middens that, and what species that they were collected there?
It's actually part of a general trend in archaeology, which is very welcome, to be much more fine-grained and look at much closer detail. Two generations ago, we would have said, oh, these people fished, and left it at that. Now, we've got people who develop the expertise by comparing ancient fish fragments with modern ones, not only to identify the fish, but to tell you how heavy they were, how long they were, and things like that, which is very interesting because often you can get information about the season they were trapped.
That's right.
Or caught, or you can get information on the size of the fish that they were aiming for. If you're, for example, catching fish for rations, you tend to go for medium or large-sized fish, and so on and so forth. And I went to a lab in Australia, actually, where there was an extraordinary collection of lagoon fish from Polynesian islands, and this sort of comparative collection is ideal because you can really identify small fragments, and this is transforming our knowledge of ancient fishing very dramatically.
Understanding the species is really important. There's a section on Baltic environments, I think it was after 10,000 BC, in these kitchen middens. It's after the Ice Age. The Scandinavians learned how to ferment fish, and one of the things that people found were huge numbers of bones of roach. And if people don't know what roach is a real small and bony fish.
It's a small, bony, shallow fish, a shallow water fish, which can be dried and eaten, and was very easily taken, which is why they took them in large numbers.
They had these long pits. Talk to me about that, about what they found in the remnants, and they found all these fish bones in them.
Say again?
Didn't they find some long pits that had all the fish bones in them?
Yes, there's one extraordinary sight in southern Sweden, which is a place where people caught and processed fish in enormous numbers. They actually, because the preservation was good and was waterlogged, they found actually the wooden troughs in which the fish were caught and then processed. So really you can look sometimes dramatically at how people caught fish, and they often fermented them and then ate them later, which is thought to have been a fairly recent technology, but actually is very ancient.
Now, you're right, the most early fishing was probably opportunistic. And why is that? You know, they've just would happen to come across the fish and then utilize that resource?
Yes, well, what you have to realize, and this is true of early seafarers, it's true of early hunters, that these people knew the environments in which they operated absolutely in minute detail. And they knew what happened in every part of the year. And they knew when fish were abundant. And they would simply make sure that that time of year they were close to the ponds or the lagoons or whatever. And this sort of opportunism is really built into human nature because hunters did the same thing. But with fishing, it's particularly important because the thing about fishing is it requires very precise observation of the behavior of fish right. and the conditions in the water and so on, which has now, of course, become a favorite pastime of recreational fishermen in fresh water.
Now, how old is shallow water spearfishing? Does that go back practically to the beginning?
One of the most extraordinary things about fishing is how little the technology has changed. Quite how old spearfishing is, we don't really know. But we suspect it's at least 17,000 to 20,000 years old. During the late Ice Age, it was with the Cro-Magnon caves and rock shelters in southwestern France. But it really became established after the Ice Age, when shallow waters, the oceans rose and people moved to the coast and there was more fishing. But the remarkable thing is, you've got spears, traps, nets, harpoons,
wow.
all these things. And they were still in use in the North Atlantic cod fishery in the 19th century and are still in use in many subsistence farming societies to this day.
Now,
and it was a technology developed from hunting.
Let's stick with the Neanderthals and early moderns. One of the things that was important, as you write about in the book, is the importance of salmon runs. Why?
For the same reason as catfish. They're predictable. You, say, take a river like the Zvezère River in southwest France or the rivers of the Pacific Northwest or the rivers of northern Japan. In spring and fall, you get these salmon runs. You may get big one or you get a small one, but here is food literally for the taking. The challenge isn't to catch the fish or to trap them. The challenge is to process enough of them, which involves cooperation of considerable numbers of people. But you get from it enough dried fish to carry through a lot of lean times. Very, very important.
Well, one of the great things that I learned, you actually credit fish as rations for building the pyramids at Giza, and you have to elaborate on why that's true.
Okay, now, if you look at pre-industrial civilizations, ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, or even the Khmer who built the magnificent Angkor Wat temples in Cambodia, you've got a situation where the rulers have to feed the commoners who do this. And the whole of ancient Egypt was based not on money, it was based on rations and the issue of rations. And the rations were bread, beer, and fish. And at the pyramids of Giza, there is indeed evidence for the baking of bread and of the presence of beer, which of course is fermented grain.
Yeah.
But there is also evidence from the pyramid construction site, or the village, the pyramid town, that they in fact had enormous workshops where fish were brought in, dried, processed, and turned into rations. And you're not talking dozens of fish. You're talking tens of thousands of fish.
Wow.
And in fact, the authorities let contracts with fishermen to bring a certain number of fish per month or per whatever season it was. And these fish which were caught, mainly catfish and mullet, were caught in shallow water, and many of them in seine nets, which are nets which you put on the bottom and lift on either side. And from this, they got the yields. But you certainly couldn't have built the pyramids, or indeed gold mined in the desert, or anything, or built a temple without all kinds of rations and fish, which is the invisible one, because we don't really look for fish bones. Certainly archaeologists 100 years ago didn't, but they are the invisible engine, as it were, that drove a great deal of ancient Egyptian civilization.
Is that one of the first cases that we know or where fish is used as a commodity?
Yes. It's one of the earliest. I would say probably the earliest. You've got fish becoming harvested. That's common. And, of course, those are a sort of commodity. When you are catching hundreds of salmon and processing, obviously it becomes a commodity. It's rather like animals, actually, or cattle. When you have a small herd, you know your cattle intimately as individuals. You give them names and so on. But if you have a large number of cattle, they become so many heads and anonymous, and you sell them in the market. Same applies to fish. But the first really widespread use of it probably was with the earliest civilizations, and the one we know best because of good preservation in dry conditions is ancient Egypt.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest is archaeological writer Brian Fagan. He's an emeritus professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And we're talking about his book, Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. It's amazing. The scope of this book is breathtaking, and it's fun. It's an enjoyable book to read. Brian, I have to talk about the Romans because I've always been fascinated by the Romans in fishing. The Romans really sort of perfected aquaculture, but they weren't the first people to use aquaculture. Were there earlier people?
The earliest people to use aquaculture that we know of are the ancient Egyptians and the Chinese. Oh, they were using it by about 3500 BC, somewhere around there. But you have to realize that aquaculture is really a very simple concept. If your catches are not as good as you want, you simply catch the fish in ponds and then take them out when you want, at its most simple level, and that's how it started. It wasn't a great invention, nor was agriculture. I mean, the results of both were dramatic. But when you get to the Romans, where a lot of the Mediterranean fisheries were fished out of large fish like Sir Mullet, and tuna were really the only large fish with the massive migrations, the Romans got into aquaculture fairly seriously. There were various types of it. One was the small-scale stuff where you got mullet and other small fish and you sold them in the local market and they were a supplement to your farming. The other one, which is the one that's most famous, is of course the farming of large fish who became trophy fish for banquets. And there are famous, very elaborate fish ponds which flourished along the Bay of Naples shore, which were big, prestigious deals for the owners of these ponds. I mean, it was the 1%, if ever anything ever was. So much so that one of the emperors, I think it was Augustine, kind of cracked down on it. But they had mullet that were changing hands for hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. But fishing was always part. Of course, the other big thing with fishing is they used a huge number of small fish to make garum, which is fish sauce. Our equivalent is probably ketchup. But you just don't think fish sauce. There are all kinds of types of fish sauce. There were vintages of fish sauce. Probably the most famous ones came from Spain, but there was a very successful garum manufacturer at Pompeii, for example, whose house they've dug up. And you got all grades from the ultra, ultra expensive stuff to the stuff that was issued to Roman soldiers. It was a huge trade, and some of it resembled the fish sauce which you find in Thailand and places like that today.
How do you make garum? It's fermented, isn't it?
Yeah, you ferment it, yeah. And you ferment it in pans. And in fact, some of the garum fermenting facilities in Spain extended over several kilometers. Also in North Africa, they were large. It was big business as far north as the Black Sea.
One of the things that really I was fascinated about is Native North Americans and how they varied in their fishing and in what they used. And I want to talk about that next. Let's talk about the Pacific Northwest coast. Who were the people that inhabited the Pacific Northwest coast?
The earliest fishing on the Pacific West Coast goes back very, very early. But if you reflect, and people aren't quite certain, that America was first settled by humans 14, 15,000 years ago, you're looking at people fishing certainly by 12,000, and there's a big debate as to how important fishing was in the settlement of the Americas and how important the coasts were. But there's no question that adaptations to the coast by Native North Americans living in the Northwest is very, very ancient. What may not be so ancient is the intensive exploitation of fisheries, which came in with more complex societies and so on in the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, and there were constant changes in this complexity of society. But the roots of the present-day people go back way into the past, and the traditions, particularly of catching salmon and also
halibut,
small heading-like fish inshore, goes back a long way, and they traded this stuff over long distances.
Now, halibut, you write, was very important to them. How did they catch halibut? When I think of halibut, I think of a monstrous fish. They were catching.
You think correctly. There were halibut are a bottom fish, and they were caught with very beautiful, very sophisticated fish hooks, which had all kinds of shapes, and they were deliberately designed for local conditions. And they would catch, because halibut on the bottom are very voracious fish.
Yeah.
The problem wasn't catching the halibut. The problem was lifting the halibut from the bottom, because they often were very heavy. And lifting a several hundred-pound halibut could be quite dangerous from a canoe. So it wasn't such a safe sort of catch as you can imagine. But they caught those in large numbers.
How did they have a special kind of spear to hold on to a catch that heavy?
They had barbed hooks, basically, and then they would try and get it up and club it. And then they also caught sturgeon, of course, where they were spearing sturgeon in shallow water and so on.
And sturgeon are huge fish, too.
They are indeed 20 foot long in the Danube in prehistoric times. And they caught those in shallow water by wrestling them ashore and clubbing them and wrestling ashore. They were dangerous fish. One flip from a tail would kill you.
Now, the Chumash Indians, which is down in the Santa Barbara Channel, they had tomols. Can you tell me what a T-O-M-O-L, tomols, what are they?
A tomol is a very unusual and very unique watercraft. It's a planked canoe, and basically how you build it, you take a hollowed-out sort of edge of a log, and then you stitch planks up to make basically a dugout canoe with planked sides, with pointed ends. These were built not of long planks. They would have been if they were in the Pacific Northwest, where they built these huge dugouts. These were built of driftwood, bits of driftwood, which were sewn together and then waterproofed with bitumen, local bitumen here. And to build one of these was A, very expensive in labor, and B, very time-consuming. So the ownership of a tomol, which was an offshore canoe, and they regularly channel across the Santa Barbara Channel and fished for swordfish in deep water. You're talking about boats that were pretty seaworthy, although the casualty rate must have been high if you got rough waves. These were remarkable fish, and so prestigious that they contributed to a very complex society, with the skippers of the canoes being people of great importance.
Again, I want to, for the benefit of the audience, we're just doing a sort of a brief outline of that. There's so much more information in the book. I want to talk about the Coosa people of Florida. Is that how you pronounce it?
The Coosa.
Coosa. What I love about your description of this, and it's very evocative the way that you talk about them, is that you have people living on the peninsula of Florida, and it's a weird landscape to live in because it's ever changing. And talk to me about why.
It's shallow. And I've sailed there a lot, and it's very shallow, which is challenging for people who have boats that have drafts of 4 feet. But the, from their point of view, these were shallow water fishermen, consummate shallow water fishermen. And they had to cope with constant sea level changes, up and down. And it's a very horizontal ocean environment. So you can imagine a sea level rise of 6 inches causes a lot of horizontal flooding. And this affected the fisheries pretty fundamentally. And the story of the Coosa is how they adjusted to this very shallow environment, very rich in fish, and adjusted to it in different ways. They also took fish in deeper inlets, fish like sharks. They even used shark skin for sandpaper. These were very sophisticated people. They built large ceremonial centers, quite complex socially, and they depended almost entirely on fish and on clams.
And this brings up an important point. All the people that we've been talking about so far, we've been talking about the fish that they've gone after. All these people, do they also go after shellfish as sort of a opportunistic food?
The silent elephant in the fishing room is shellfish and mollusks. And there is no question that people have been collecting mollusks for at least 100,000 years, probably much longer. The importance of mollusks is that they are predictable. You know they're there, and they are a very important backup food in the scarce months, or were, for many, many societies. And there is a remarkable study done about 30 years ago by an archaeologist in northern Australia who spent a lot of time among Australian Aboriginal groups who were still living off shellfish. And they described their shoreline, which looks, to be perfectly frank, not particularly promising in terms of food. They described it as a supermarket. And she wrote this fascinating study of how they adjusted to different times of the year, different weather conditions, and yet lived very, very comfortably, almost entirely off shellfish. Not entirely, but almost entirely.
One of the most amazing stories in this book that's filled with amazing stories is the Lapita peoples of the Bismarck Archipelago. And then when you start getting out into the Fijians, and these people mastered canoeing huge distances across the ocean. And that story in itself is really pretty amazing. These people did what, mostly spearfishing?
They did. It's interesting. They were deep water fishermen, but they also were lagoon fishermen. And most of their fishing was spears and hooks and lines and nets. The one I really love is back in the 1920s, there was a journalist who had an interest in fishing. He was a recreational fisher. He was around in Tahiti at the time of a famous recreational fisherman called Zane Grey, who was also an author. But he wrote this marvelous description of pursuing bonito with a canoe, in canoes. He went out with the people doing it, and how they cast nets with brightly colored hooks. They would hook, and they would whip it in the boat and whip it out again, like he's just like playing a game of tennis, which I thought was the most marvelous description. There was nothing these people didn't know about catching fish, and they didn't have electronic machines or anything like that.
They also poisoned fish, too. Is that in lagoon fishing?
Yeah. Most societies did.
Now, you have to explain that, because people are thinking one thing, and what the reality was very different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were using natural plants to poison?
Mainly toxic plants of various sorts, yeah. Mm-hmm. And basically the fish were stunned and they'd pick them up. It was quite common in Polynesia, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did they navigate? It's like one of the most...
They navigated like you can today. All sorts of different ways. The first thing they did, as I said earlier, there was nothing they didn't know about the ocean, about waves, wind patterns, clouds, the habits of birds, the habits of fish.
Wow.
And the heavenly bodies. And a lot of this navigation was done by using the stars and the sun. And if you were a Pacific canoe navigator, you served a long apprenticeship, which began probably when you're about 7 or 8, and you would go to sea with the pilots, and you learnt with mnemonics because there was no writing. You passed information from one generation to the next in chants and songs and mnemonics. And this information about which stars appeared when and what seasons was in the kind of drilled into their brains to the point where they could literally glance at the sky and have a good idea what was going on and what was setting. And they used these to travel across what apparently was featureless ocean.
We're almost out of time, but I just want to talk about one thing. At the very beginning of this book, you say that fishers have always been anonymous folks. Can you expand on that? What does that mean?
It's very important to realize that fishing, in a way, is a form of esoteric knowledge, because you know things about the ocean on the surface and below it. And if you look, and I'm not promoting the book, but if you look at the frontispiece of the book, there is a magnificent painting of two northern Danish fishermen from 1879, painted by a guy called Michael Anker. Take a look at their faces. The sea is etched into those faces. And these guys were laconic. They didn't say much. But they quietly passed their information on to the next generation. So this information, which was very closely held, was kept to themselves. And by the nature of fishing, they tend to be on the fringes of society and very clannish. And put all this together, and it still survives. You talk to a lot of fishermen today, they won't tell you a lot.
We're going to end on that.
I'm serious.
It's true. It's part of the tradition of fishing. We are completely out of time, and we could talk about this book for years. We've only scratched the surface of the first part of the book. My guest tonight is archaeological writer Brian Fagan, emeritus professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and we've been talking about his book. It's just an amazing read. Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. Brian, it's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure, too.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.